But fire is something continually changing, and its permanence is rather that of a process than that of a substance, though this view should not be attributed to Heraclitus. Science, like philosophy, has sought to escape from the doctrine of perpetual flux by finding some permanent substratum amid changing phenomena. Chemistry seemed to satisfy this desire. It was found that fire, which appears to destroy, only transmutes. Elements are recombined. But each atom that existed before combustion still exists when the process is completed. Accordingly, it was supposed that atoms are indestructible, and that all change in the physical world consists merely in rearrangement of persistent elements. This view prevailed until the discovery of radioactivity, when it was found that atoms could disintegrate. Nothing daunted, the physicists invented new and smaller units, called electrons and protons, out of which atoms were composed. And these units were supposed, for a few years, to have the indestructibility formerly attributed to atoms. Unfortunately, it seemed that protons and electrons could meet and explode, forming not new matter, but a wave of energy spreading through the universe with the velocity of light. Energy had to replace matter as what is permanent. But energy, unlike matter, is not a refinement of the common sense notion of a thing. It is merely a characteristic of physical processes. It might be fancifully identified with the Heraclitean fire, but it is the burning, not what burns. What burns has disappeared from modern physics. Passing from the small to the large, astronomy no longer allows us to regard the heavenly bodies as everlasting. The planets came out of the sun, and the sun came out of a nebula. It has lasted some time, and will last some time longer, but sooner or later, probably in about a million years, it will explode, destroying all the planets, and reverting to the condition of a widely diffused gas. So at least the astronomers say. Perhaps as the fatal day draws nearer, they will find some mistake in their calculations. The doctrine of the perpetual flux, as taught by Heraclitus, is painful, and science, as we have seen, can do nothing to refute it. One of the main ambitions of philosophers has been to revive hopes that science seemed to have killed. Philosophers, accordingly, have sought with great persistence for something not subject to the empire of time. This search begins with Parmenides. Chapter 5. Parmenides. The Greeks were not addicted to moderation, either in their theories or in their practice. Heraclitus maintained that everything changes. Parmenides retorted that nothing changes. Parmenides was a native of Elea, in the south of Italy, and flourished in the first half of the 5th century BC. According to Plato, Socrates in his youth, say about the year 450 BC, had an interview with Parmenides, then an old man, and learnt much from him. Whether or not this interview is historical, we may at least infer, what is otherwise evident, that Plato himself was influenced by the doctrines of Parmenides. The South Italian and Sicilian philosophers were more inclined to mysticism and religion than those of Ionia, who were on the whole scientific and skeptical in their tendencies. But mathematics, under the influence of Pythagoras, flourished more in Magna Graecia than in Ionia. Mathematics at that time, however, was entangled with mysticism. Parmenides was influenced by Pythagoras, but the extent of this influence is conjectural. What makes Parmenides historically important is that he invented a form of metaphysical argument that, in one form or another, is to be found in most subsequent metaphysicians, down to and including Hegel. He is often said to have invented logic, but what he really invented was metaphysics based on logic. The doctrine of Parmenides was set forth in a poem, On Nature. He considered the senses deceptive, and condemned the multitude of sensible things as mere illusion. The only true being is the One, which is infinite and indivisible. It is not, as in Heraclitus, a union of opposites, since there are no opposites. He apparently thought, for instance, that cold means only not hot, and dark means only not light. The One is not conceived by Parmenides as we conceive God. He seems to think of it as material and extended, for he speaks of it as a sphere. But it cannot be divided, because the whole of it is present everywhere. Parmenides divides his teaching into two parts, called respectively the way of truth and the way of opinion. We need not concern ourselves with the latter. What he says about the way of truth, so far as it has survived, is, in its essential points, as follows. Thou canst not know what is not, that is impossible, nor utter it, for it is the same thing that can be thought and that can be. How, then, can what is be going to be in the future? Or how could it come into being? If it came into being, it is not. Nor is it if it is going to be in the future. Thus is becoming extinguished, and passing away not to be heard of. The thing that can be thought, and that for the sake of which the thought exists, is the same. For you cannot find thought without something that is, as to which it is uttered. Footnote. Burnett's note. The meaning, I think, is this. There can be no thought corresponding to a name that is not the name of something real. End of footnote. The essence of this argument is, when you think of something. When you use a name, it must be the name of something. Therefore, both thought and language require objects outside themselves. And since you can think of a thing or speak of it at one time as well as at another, whatever can be thought of or spoken of must exist at all times. Consequently, there can be no change, since change consists in things coming into being or ceasing to be. This is the first example in philosophy of an argument from thought and language to the world at large. It cannot, of course, be accepted as valid, but it is worthwhile to see what element of truth it contains. We can put the argument in this way. If language is not just nonsense, words must mean something. And in general, they must not mean just other words, but something that is there, whether we talk of it or not. Suppose, for example, that you talk of George Washington. Unless there were a historical person who had that name, the name, it would seem, would be meaningless, and sentences containing the name would be nonsense. Parmenides maintains that not only must George Washington have existed in the past, but in some sense he must still exist, since we can still use his name significantly. This seems obviously untrue, but how are we to get round the argument? Let us take an imaginary person, say Hamlet. Consider the statement, Hamlet was Prince of Denmark. In some sense, this is true, but not in the plain historical sense. The true statement is, Shakespeare says that Hamlet was Prince of Denmark, or, more explicitly, Shakespeare says there was a Prince of Denmark called Hamlet. Here, there is no longer anything imaginary. Shakespeare and Denmark and the noise Hamlet are all real. But the noise Hamlet is not really a name, since nobody is really called Hamlet. If you say Hamlet is the name of an imaginary person, that is not strictly correct. You ought to say it is imagined that Hamlet is the name of a real person. Hamlet is an imagined individual. Unicorns are an imagined species. Some sentences in which the word unicorn occurs are true, and some are false, but in each case not directly. Consider a unicorn has one horn and a cow has two horns. To prove the latter, you have to look at a cow. It is not enough to say that in some book cows are said to have two horns. But the evidence that unicorns have one horn is only to be found in books. And in fact, the correct statement is, certain books assert that there are animals with one horn called unicorns. All statements about unicorns are really about the word unicorn, just as all statements about Hamlet are really about the word Hamlet. But it is obvious that in most cases we are not speaking of words, but of what the words mean. And this brings us back to the argument of Parmenides, that if a word can be used significantly, it must mean something, not nothing. And therefore, what the word means must in some sense exist. What then are we to say about George Washington? It seems we have only two alternatives. One is to say that he still exists. The other is to say that when we use the words George Washington, we are not really speaking of the man who bore that name. Either seems a paradox, but the latter is less of a paradox, and I shall try to show a sense in which it is true. Parmenides assumes that words have a constant meaning. This is really the basis of his argument, which he supposes unquestionable. But although the dictionary, or the encyclopedia, gives what may be called the official and socially sanctioned meaning of a word, no two people who use the same word have just the same thought in their minds. George Washington himself could use his name and the word I as synonyms. He could perceive his own thoughts and the movements of his body, and could therefore use his name with a fuller meaning than was possible for anyone else. His friends, when in his presence, could perceive the movements of his body and could divine his thoughts. To them, the name George Washington still denoted something concrete in their own experience. After his death, they had to substitute memories for perceptions, which involved a change in the mental processes taking place when they used his name. For us, who never knew him, the mental processes are again different. We may think of his picture and say to ourselves, "Yes, that man." We may think, "The first president of the United States." If we are very ignorant, he may be to us merely the man who was called George Washington. Whatever the name suggests to us, it must be not the man himself, since we never knew him, but something now present to sense or memory or thought. This shows the fallacy of the argument of Parmenides. This perpetual change in the meanings of words is concealed by the fact that, in general, the change makes no difference to the truth or falsehood of the propositions in which the words occur. If you take any true sentence in which the name George Washington occurs, it will, as a rule, remain true if you substitute the phrase, "the first president of the United States." There are exceptions to this rule. Before Washington's election, a man might say, "I hope George Washington will be the first president of the United States," but he would not say, "I hope the first president of the United States will be the first president of the United States," unless he had an unusual passion for the law of identity. But it is easy to make a rule for excluding these exceptional cases, and in those that remain, you may substitute for George Washington any descriptive phrase that applies to him alone. And it is only by means of such phrases that we know what we know about him. Parmenides contends that since we can now know what is commonly regarded as past, it cannot really be past, but must, in some sense, exist now. Hence he infers that there is no such thing as change. What we have been saying about George Washington meets this argument. It may be said, in a sense, that we have no knowledge of the past. When you recollect, the recollection occurs now and is not identical with the event recollected. But the recollection affords a description of the past event. And for most practical purposes, it is unnecessary to distinguish between the description and what it describes. This whole argument shows how easy it is to draw metaphysical conclusions from language, and how the only way to avoid fallacious arguments of this kind is to push the logical and psychological study of language further than has been done by most metaphysicians. I think, however, that if Parmenides could return from the dead and read what I have been saying, he would regard it as very superficial. "How do you know," he would ask, "that your statements about George Washington refer to a past time? By your own account, the direct reference is to things now present. Your recollections, for instance, happen now, not at the time that you think you recollect. If memory is to be accepted as a source of knowledge, the past must be before the mind now, and must therefore, in some sense, still exist." I will not attempt to meet this argument now. It requires a discussion of memory, which is a difficult subject. I have put the argument here to remind the reader that philosophical theories, if they are important, can generally be revived in a new form after being refuted as originally stated. Refutations are seldom final. In most cases, they are only a prelude to further refinements. What subsequent philosophy, down to quite modern times, accepted from Parmenides was not the impossibility of all change, which was too violent a paradox, but the indestructibility of substance. The word substance did not occur in his immediate successors, but the concept is already present in their speculations. A substance was supposed to be the persistent subject of varying predicates. As such, it became, and remained, for more than 2,000 years, one of the fundamental concepts of philosophy, psychology, physics, and theology. I shall have much to say about it at a later stage. For the present, I am merely concerned to note that it was introduced as a way of doing justice to the arguments of Parmenides without denying obvious facts. Chapter 6. Empedocles. The mixture of philosopher, prophet, man of science, and charlatan, which we found already in Pythagoras, was exemplified very completely in Empedocles, who flourished about 440 BC and was thus a younger contemporary of Parmenides, though his doctrine had in some ways more affinity with that of Heraclitus. He was a citizen of Acragas on the south coast of Sicily. He was a democratic politician who at the same time claimed to be a god. In most Greek cities, and especially in those of Sicily, there was a constant conflict between democracy and tyranny. The leaders of whichever party was at the moment defeated were executed or exiled. Those who were exiled seldom scrupled to enter into negotiations with the enemies of Greece, Persia in the east, Carthage in the west. Empedocles, in due course, was banished, but he appears, after his banishment, to have preferred the career of a sage to that of an intriguing refugee. It seems probable that in youth he was more or less Orphic, that before his exile he combined politics and science, and that it was only in later life, as an exile, that he became a prophet. Legend had much to say about Empedocles. He was supposed to have worked miracles, or what seemed such, sometimes by magic, sometimes by means of his scientific knowledge. He could control the winds, we are told. He restored to life a woman who had seemed dead for 30 days. Finally, it is said, he died by leaping into the crater of Etna to prove that he was a god. In the words of the poet, "Great Empedocles, that ardent soul, leapt into Etna and was roasted whole." Matthew Arnold wrote a poem on this subject, but although one of his worst, it does not contain the above couplet. Like Parmenides, Empedocles wrote in verse. Lucretius, who was influenced by him, praised him highly as a poet, but on this subject opinions were divided. Since only fragments of his writings have survived, his poetic merit must remain in doubt. It is necessary to deal separately with his science and his religion, as they are not consistent with each other. I shall consider first his science, then his philosophy, and finally his religion. His most important contribution to science was his discovery of air as a separate substance. This he proved by the observation that when a bucket or any similar vessel is put upside down into water, the water does not enter into the bucket. He says, "When a girl, playing with a water clock of shining brass, puts the orifice of the pipe upon her comely hand and dips the water clock into the yielding mass of silvery water, the stream does not then flow into the vessel, but the bulk of the air inside, pressing upon the close-packed perforations, keeps it out, till she uncovers the compressed stream. But then air escapes, and an equal volume of water runs in." This passage occurs in an explanation of respiration. He also discovered at least one example of centrifugal force, that if a cup of water is whirled around at the end of a string, the water does not come out. He knew that there is sex in plants, and he had a theory, somewhat fantastic it must be admitted, of evolution and the survival of the fittest. Originally, countless tribes of mortal creatures were scattered abroad, endowed with all manner of forms, a wonder to behold. There were heads without necks, arms without shoulders, eyes without foreheads, solitary limbs seeking for union. These things joined together as each might chance. There were shambling creatures with countless hands, creatures with faces and breasts looking in different directions, creatures with the bodies of oxen and the faces of men, and others with the faces of oxen and the bodies of men. There were hermaphrodites combining the natures of men and women, but sterile. In the end, only certain forms survived. As regards astronomy, he knew that the moon shines by reflected light, and thought that this is also true of the sun. He said that light takes time to travel, but so little time that we cannot observe it. He knew that solar eclipses are caused by the interposition of the moon, a fact which he seems to have learnt from Anaxagoras. He was the founder of the Italian school of medicine, and the medical school which sprang from him influenced both Plato and Aristotle. According to Burnett, page 234, it affected the whole tendency of scientific and philosophical thinking. All this shows the scientific vigor of his time, which was not equaled in the later ages of Greece. I come now to his cosmology. It was he, as already mentioned, who established earth, air, fire, and water as the four elements, though the word element was not used by him. Each of these was everlasting, but they could be mixed in different proportions, and thus produce the changing, complex substances that we find in the world. They were combined by love and separated by strife. Love and strife were, for Empedocles, primitive substances on a level with earth, air, fire, and water. There were periods when love was in the ascendant, and others when strife was the stronger. There had been a golden age when love was completely victorious. In that age, men worshipped only the Cyprian Aphrodite. The changes in the world are not governed by any purpose, but only by chance and necessity. There is a cycle. When the elements have been thoroughly mixed by love, strife gradually sorts them out again. When strife has separated them, love gradually reunites them. Thus, every compound substance is temporary. Only the elements, together with love and strife, are everlasting. There is a similarity to Heraclitus, but a softening, since it is not strife alone, but strife and love together that produce change. Plato couples Heraclitus and Empedocles in the Sophist, 242. There are Ionian, and in more recent time, Sicilian muses, who have arrived at the conclusion that to unite the two principles of the one and the many is safer, and to say that being is one and many, and that these are held together by enmity and friendship, ever parting, ever meeting, as the severer muses assert, while the gentler ones do not insist on the perpetual strife and peace, but admit a relaxation and alternation of them. Peace and unity sometimes prevailing under the sway of Aphrodite, and then again plurality and war by reason of a principle of strife. Empedocles held that the material world is a sphere, that in the Golden Age strife was outside and love inside. Then gradually strife entered and love was expelled, until at the worst strife will be wholly within and love wholly without the sphere. Then, though for what reason is not clear, an opposite movement begins until the Golden Age returns, but not forever. The whole cycle is then repeated. One might have supposed that either extreme could be stable, but that is not the view of Empedocles. He wished to explain motion while taking account of the arguments of Parmenides, and he had no wish to arrive at any stage at an unchanging universe. The views of Empedocles on religion are, in the main, Pythagorean. In a fragment which, in all likelihood, refers to Pythagoras, he says, "There was among them a man of rare knowledge, most skilled in all manner of wise works, a man who had won the utmost wealth of wisdom. For whensoever he strained with all his mind, he easily saw everything of all the things that are, in 10, yea, 20 lifetimes of men." In the Golden Age, as already mentioned, men worshipped only Aphrodite, and the altar did not reek with pure bull's blood, but this was held in the greatest abomination among men, to eat the goodly limbs after tearing out the life. At one time he speaks of himself exuberantly as a god. "Friends that inhabit the great city, looking down on the yellow rock of Acragas, up by the citadel, busy in goodly works, harbour of honour for the stranger, men unskilled in meanness, all hail. I go about among you an immortal god, no mortal now, honoured among all as is meet, crowned with fillets and flowery garlands. Straightway, whenever I enter with these in my train, both men and women into the flourishing towns is reverence done me. They go after me in countless throngs, asking of me what is the way to gain, some desiring oracles, while some, who for many a weary day have been pierced by the grievous pangs of all manner of sickness, beg to hear from me the word of healing. But why do I harp on these things, as if it were any great matter that that I should surpass mortal, perishable men. At another time, he feels himself a great sinner, undergoing expiation for his impiety. There is an oracle of necessity, an ancient ordinance of the gods, eternal and sealed fast by broad oaths, that whenever one of the demons, whose portion is length of days, has sinfully polluted his hands with blood, or followed strife and forsworn himself, he must wander thrice 10,000 years from the abodes of the blessed, being born throughout the time in all manners of mortal forms, changing one toilsome path of life for another. For the mighty air drives him into the sea, and the sea spews him forth upon the dry earth. Earth tosses him into the beams of the blazing sun, and he flings him back to the eddies of air. One takes him from the other, and all reject him. One of these I now am, an exile and a wanderer from the gods, for that I put my trust in insensate strife. What his sin had been, we do not know, perhaps nothing that we should think very grievous, for he says, "Ah, woe is me, that the pitiless day of death did not destroy me, ere ever I wrought evil deeds of devouring with my lips. Abstain wholly from laurel leaves. Wretches, utter wretches, keep your hands from beans." So perhaps he had done nothing worse than munching laurel leaves or guzzling beans. The most famous passage in Plato, in which he compares this world to a cave, in which we see only shadows of the realities in the bright world above, is anticipated by Empedocles. Its origin is in the teaching of the Orphics. There are some, presumably those who abstain from sin through many incarnations, who at last achieve immortal bliss in the company of the gods. But at last they appear among mortal men as prophets. Footnote. It does not appear who they are, but one may assume that they are those who have preserved purity. End of footnote. Songwriters, physicians, and princes. And thence they rise up as gods exalted in honor, sharing the hearth of the other gods in the same table, free from human woes, safe from destiny, and incapable of hurt. In all this, it would seem, there is very little that was not already contained in the teaching of Orphism and Pythagoreanism. The originality of Empedocles, outside science, consists in the doctrine of the four elements and in the use of the two principles of love and strife to explain change. He rejected monism and regarded the course of nature as regulated by chance and necessity rather than by purpose. In these respects, his philosophy was more scientific than those of Parmenides, Plato, and Aristotle. In other respects, it is true, he acquiesced in current superstitions, but in this he was no worse than many more recent men of science. Chapter 7. Athens in relation to culture. The greatness of Athens begins at the time of the two Persian wars, 490 BC and 480 to 79 BC. Before that time, Ionia and Magna Graecia, the Greek cities of South Italy and Sicily, produced the great men. The victory of Athens against the Persian king Darius at Marathon, 490, and of the combined Greek fleets against his son and successor, Xerxes, 480, under Athenian leadership, gave Athens great prestige. The Ionians in the islands and on part of the mainland of Asia Minor had rebelled against Persia, and their liberation was effected by Athens after the Persians had been driven from the mainland of Greece. In this operation, the Spartans, who cared only about their own territory, took no part. Thus, Athens became the predominant partner in an alliance against Persia. By the constitution of the alliance, any constituent state was bound to contribute either a specified number of ships or the cost of them. Most chose the latter, and thus Athens acquired naval supremacy over the other allies and gradually transformed the alliance into an Athenian empire. Athens became rich and prospered under the wise leadership of Pericles, who governed by the free choice of the citizens for about 30 years until his fall in 430 BC. The age of Pericles was the happiest and most glorious time in the history of Athens. Aeschylus, who had fought in the Persian Wars, inaugurated Greek tragedy. One of his tragedies, the Persae, departing from the custom of choosing Homeric subjects, deals with the defeat of Darius. He was quickly followed by Sophocles, and Sophocles by Euripides, who, however, extends into the dark days of the Peloponnesian War that followed the fall and death of Pericles, and reflects in his plays the skepticism of the later period. His contemporary, Aristophanes, the comic poet, makes fun of all isms from the standpoint of robust and limited common sense. More particularly, he holds up Socrates to obloquy as one who denies the existence of Zeus and dabbles in unholy pseudo-scientific mysteries. Athens had been captured by Xerxes, and the temples on the Acropolis had been destroyed by fire. Pericles devoted himself to their reconstruction. The Parthenon and the other temples, whose ruins remain to impress our age, were built by him. Phidias, the sculptor, was employed by the state to make colossal statues of gods and goddesses. At the end of this period, Athens was the most beautiful and splendid city of the Hellenic world. Herodotus, the father of history, was a native of Halicarnassus in Asia Minor, but lived in Athens, was encouraged by the Athenian state, and wrote his account of the Persian Wars from the Athenian point of view. The achievements of Athens in the time of Pericles are perhaps the most astonishing thing in all history. Until that time, Athens had lagged behind many other Greek cities. Neither in art nor in literature had it produced any great man, except Solon, who was primarily a lawgiver. Suddenly, under the stimulus of Victorian wealth and the need of reconstruction, architects, sculptors, and dramatists, who remain unsurpassed to the present day, produced works which dominated the future down to modern times. This is the more surprising when we consider the smallness of the population involved. Athens at its maximum, about 430 BC, is estimated to have numbered about 230,000, including slaves, and the surrounding territory of rural Attica probably contained a rather smaller population. Never before or since has anything approaching the same proportion of the inhabitants of any area shown itself capable of work of the highest excellence. In philosophy, Athens contributes only two great names, Socrates and Plato. Plato belongs to a somewhat later period, but Socrates passed his youth and early manhood under Pericles. The Athenians were sufficiently interested in philosophy to listen eagerly to teachers from other cities. The sophists were sought after by young men who wished to learn the art of disputation. In the Protagoras, the Platonic Socrates gives an amusing, satirical description of the ardent disciples hanging on the words of the eminent visitor. Pericles, as we shall see, imported Anaxagoras, from whom Socrates professed to have learned the preeminence of mind in creation. Most of Plato's dialogues are supposed by him to take place during the time of Pericles, and they give an agreeable picture of life among the rich. Plato belonged to an aristocratic Athenian family and grew up in the tradition of the period before war and democracy had destroyed the wealth and security of the upper classes. His young men, who have no need to work, spend most of their leisure in the pursuit of science and mathematics and philosophy. They know Homer almost by heart and are critical judges of the merits of professional reciters of poetry. The art of deductive reasoning had been lately discovered and afforded the excitement of new theories, both true and false, over the whole field of knowledge. It was possible in that age, as in few others, to be both intelligent and happy through intelligence. But the balance of forces which produced this golden age was precarious. It was threatened both from within and from within by the democracy and from without by Sparta. To understand what happened after Pericles, we must consider briefly the earlier history of Attica. Attica, at the beginning of the historical period, was a self-supporting little agricultural region. Athens, its capital, was not large, but contained a growing population of artisans and skilled artificers, who desired to dispose of their produce abroad. Gradually, it was found more profitable to cultivate vines and olives rather than grain, and to import grain, chiefly from the coast of the Black Sea. This form of cultivation required more capital than the cultivation of grain, and the small farmers got into debt. Attica, like other Greek states, had been a monarchy in the Homeric age, but the king became a merely religious official without political power. the government fell into the hands of the aristocracy, who oppressed both the country farmers and the urban artisans. A compromise in the direction of democracy was effected by Solon early in the 6th century, and much of his work survived through a subsequent period of tyranny under Pisistratus and his sons. When this period came to an end, the aristocrats, as the opponents of tyranny, were able to recommend themselves to the democracy. Until the fall of Pericles, democratic processes gave power to the aristocracy, as in 19th century England. But towards the end of his life, the leaders of the Athenian democracy began to demand a larger share of political power. At the same time, his imperialist policy, with which the economic prosperity of Athens was bound up, caused increasing friction with Sparta, leading at last to the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404, in which Athens was completely defeated. In spite of political collapse, the prestige of Athens survived, and throughout almost a millennium, philosophy was centered there. Alexandria eclipsed Athens in mathematics and science, but Aristotle and Plato had made Athens philosophically supreme. The academy, where Plato had taught, survived all other schools, and persisted as an island of paganism for 2 centuries after the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity. At last, in AD 529, it was closed by Justinian because of his religious bigotry, and the Dark Ages descended upon Europe. Chapter 8. Anaxagoras. The philosopher Anaxagoras, though not the equal of Pythagoras, Heraclitus, or Parmenides, has nevertheless a considerable historical importance. He was an Ionian and carried on the scientific rationalist tradition of Ionia. He was the first to introduce philosophy to the Athenians and the first to suggest mind as the primary cause of physical changes. He was born at Clazomenae in Ionia about the year 500 BC. But he spent about 30 years of his life in Athens, approximately from 462 to 432 BC. He was probably induced to come by Pericles, who was bent on civilizing his fellow townsmen. Perhaps Aspasia, who came from Miletus, introduced him to Pericles. Plato, in the Phaedrus, says, "Pericles fell in, it seems, with Anaxagoras, who was a scientific man, and satiating himself with the theory of things on high, and having attained to a knowledge of the true nature of intellect and folly, which were just what the discourses of Anaxagoras were mainly about, he drew from that source whatever was of a nature to further him in the art of speech." It is said that Anaxagoras also influenced Euripides, but this is more doubtful. The citizens of Athens, like those of other cities in other ages and continents, showed a certain hostility to those who attempted to introduce a higher level of culture than that to which they were accustomed. When Pericles was growing old, his opponents began a campaign against him by attacking his friends. They accused Phidias of embezzling some of the gold that was to be employed on his statues. They passed a law permitting impeachment of those who did not practice religion and taught theories about the things on high. Under this law, they prosecuted Anaxagoras, who was accused of teaching that the sun was a red-hot stone and the moon was earth. The same accusation was repeated by the prosecutors of Socrates, who made fun of them for being out of date. What happened is not certain, except that he had to leave Athens. It seems probable that Pericles got him out of prison and managed to get him away. He returned to Ionia, where he founded a school. In accordance with his will, the anniversary of his death was kept as a school children's holiday. Anaxagoras held that everything is infinitely divisible, and that even the smallest portion of matter contains some of each element. Things appear to be that of which they contain most. Thus, for example, everything contains some fire, but we only call it fire if that element preponderates. Like Empedocles, he argues against the void, saying that the clepsydra, or an inflated skin, shows that there is air where there seems to be nothing. He differed from his predecessors in regarding mind, nous, as a substance which enters into the composition of living things and distinguishes them from dead matter. In everything, he says, there is a portion of everything except mind, and some things contain mind also. Mind has power over all things that have life. It is infinite and self-ruled, and is mixed with nothing. Except as regards mind, everything, however small, contains portions of all opposites, such as hot and cold, white and black. He maintained that snow is black, in part. Mind is the source of all motion. It causes a rotation, which is gradually spreading throughout the world, and is causing the lightest things to go to the circumference, and the heaviest to fall towards the center. Mind is uniform, and is just as good in animals as in man. Man's apparent superiority is due to the fact that he has hands. All seeming differences of intelligence are really due to bodily differences. Both Aristotle and the Platonic Socrates complain that Anaxagoras, after introducing mind, makes very little use of it. Aristotle points out that he only introduces mind as a cause when he knows no other. Whenever he can, he gives a mechanical explanation. He rejected necessity and chance as giving the origins of things. Nevertheless, there was no providence in his cosmology. He does not seem to have thought much about ethics or religion. Probably he was an atheist, as his prosecutors maintained. All his predecessors influenced him except Pythagoras. The influence of Parmenides was the same in his case as in that of Empedocles. In science, he had great merit. It was he who first explained that the moon shines by reflected light, though there is a cryptic fragment in Parmenides suggesting that he also knew this. Anaxagoras gave the correct theory of eclipses and knew that the moon is below the sun. The sun and stars, he said, are fiery stones, but we do not feel the heat of the stars because they are too distant. The sun is larger than the Peloponnesus. The moon has mountains and, he thought, inhabitants. Anaxagoras is said to have been of the school of Anaximenes. Certainly he kept alive the rationalist and scientific tradition of the Ionians. One does not find in him the ethical and religious preoccupations which, passing from the Pythagoreans to Socrates and from Socrates to Plato, brought an obscurantist bias into Greek philosophy. He is not quite in the first rank, but he is important as the first to bring philosophy to Athens and as one of the influences that helped to form Socrates. Chapter 9. The Atomists. The founders of atomism were two: Leucippus and Democritus. It is difficult to disentangle them because they are generally mentioned together, and apparently some of the works of Leucippus were subsequently attributed to Democritus. Leucippus, who seems to have flourished about 440 BC, footnote, Cyril Bailey, the Greek Atomists and Epicurus, estimates that he flourished about 430 BC or a little earlier, end of footnote, came from Miletus, and carried on the scientific rationalist philosophy associated with that city. He was much influenced by Parmenides and Zeno. So little is known of him that Epicurus, a later follower of Democritus, was thought to have denied his existence altogether, and some moderns have revived this theory. There are, however, a number of allusions to him in Aristotle, and it seems incredible that these, which include textual quotations, would have occurred if he had been merely a myth. Democritus is a much more definite figure. He was a native of Abdera in Thrace. As for his date, he stated that he was young when Anaxagoras was old, say about 432 BC, and he is taken to have flourished about 420 BC. He travelled widely in southern and eastern lands in search of knowledge. He perhaps spent a considerable time in Egypt, and he certainly visited Persia. He then returned to Abdera, where he remained. Zeller calls him superior to all earlier and contemporary philosophers in wealth of knowledge, and to most in acuteness and logical correctness of thinking. Democritus was a contemporary of Socrates and the Sophists, and should, on purely chronological grounds, be treated somewhat later in our history. The difficulty is that he is so hard to separate from Leucippus. On this ground, I am considering him before Socrates and the Sophists. Although part of his philosophy was intended as an answer to Protagoras, his fellow townsman, and the most eminent of the Sophists. Protagoras, when he visited Athens, was received enthusiastically. Democritus, on the other hand, says, "I went to Athens and no one knew me." For a long time, his philosophy was ignored in Athens. It is not clear, says Burnett, that Plato knew anything about Democritus. Aristotle, on the other hand, knows Democritus well, for he too was an Ionian from the north. Plato never mentions him in the dialogues, but is said by Diogenes Laertius to have disliked him so much that he wished all his books burnt. Heath esteems him highly as a mathematician. The fundamental ideas of the common philosophy of Leucippus and Democritus were due to the former, but as regards the working out, it is hardly possible to disentangle them, nor is it, for our purposes, important to make the attempt. Leucippus, if not Democritus, was led to atomism in the attempt to mediate between monism and pluralism, as represented by Parmenides and Empedocles, respectively. Their point of view was remarkably like that of modern science, and avoided most of the faults to which Greek speculation was prone. They believed that everything is composed of atoms, which are physically but not geometrically indivisible, that between the atoms there is empty space, that atoms are indestructible, that they always have been and always will be in motion, that there are an infinite number of atoms, and even of kinds of atoms, the differences being as regards shape and size. Aristotle asserts that according to the atomists, atoms also differ as regards heat, the spherical atoms which compose fire being the hottest. And as regards weight, he quotes Democritus as saying, "The more any indivisible exceeds, the heavier it is." But the question whether atoms are originally possessed of weight in the theories of the atomists is a controversial one. The atoms were always in motion, but there is disagreement among commentators as to the character of the original motion. Some, especially Zeller, hold that the atoms were thought to be always falling, and that the heavier ones fell faster. They thus caught up the lighter ones, there were impacts, and the atoms were deflected like billiard balls. This was certainly the view of Epicurus, who in most respects based his theories on those of Democritus, while trying, rather unintelligently, to take account of Aristotle's criticisms. But there is considerable reason to think that weight was not an original property of the atoms of Leucippus and Democritus. It seems more probable that, on their view, atoms were originally moving at random, as in the modern kinetic theory of gases. Democritus said, "There was neither up nor down in the infinite void," and compared the movement of atoms in the soul to that of motes in a sunbeam when there is no wind. This is a much more intelligent view than that of Epicurus, and I think we may assume it to have been that of Leucippus and Democritus. Footnote: this interpretation is adopted by Burnet, and also, at least as regards Leucippus, by Bailey. End of footnote. As a result of collisions, collections of atoms came to form vortices. The rest proceeded much as in Anaxagoras, but it was an advance to explain the vortices mechanically rather than as due to the action of mind. It was common in antiquity to reproach the atomists with attributing everything to chance. They were, on the contrary, strict determinists, who believed that everything happens in accordance with natural laws. Democritus explicitly denied that anything can happen by chance. Leucippus, though his existence is questioned, is known to have said one thing: "Naught happens for nothing, but everything from a ground and of necessity." It is true that he gave no reason why the world should originally have been as it was. This perhaps might have been attributed to chance. But when once the world existed, its further development was unalterably fixed by mechanical principles. Aristotle and others reproached him and Democritus for not accounting for the original motion of the atoms, but in this the atomists were more scientific than their critics. Causation must start from something, and wherever it starts, no cause can be assigned for the initial datum. The world may be attributed to a creator, but even then the creator himself is unaccounted for. The theory of the atomists, in fact, was more nearly that of modern science than any other theory propounded in antiquity. The atomists, unlike Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, sought to explain the world without introducing the notion of purpose or final cause. The final cause of an occurrence is an event in the future for the sake of which the occurrence takes place. In human affairs, this conception is applicable. Why does the baker make bread? Because people will be hungry. Why are railways built? Because people will wish to travel. In such cases, things are explained by the purpose they serve. When we ask why concerning an event, we may mean either of two things. We may mean, what purpose did this event serve? Or we may mean, what earlier circumstances caused this event? The answer to the former question is teleological explanation, or an explanation by final causes. The answer to the latter question is a mechanistic explanation. I do not see how it could have been known in advance which of these two questions science ought to ask, or whether it ought to ask both. But experience has shown that the mechanistic question leads to scientific knowledge, while the teleological question does not. The atomists asked the mechanistic question and gave a mechanistic answer. Their successors, until the Renaissance, were more interested in the teleological question and thus led science up a blind alley. In regard to both questions alike, there is a limitation which is often ignored, both in popular thought and in philosophy. Neither question can be asked intelligibly about reality as a whole, including God, but only about parts of it. As regards the teleological explanation, it usually arrives before long at a creator, or at least an artificer, whose purposes are realized in the course of nature. But if a man is so obstinately teleological as to continue to ask what purpose is served by the creator, it becomes obvious that his question is impious. It is, moreover, unmeaning, since to make it significant, we should have to suppose the creator created by some super-creator whose purposes he served. The conception of purpose, therefore, is only applicable within reality, not to reality as a whole. A not dissimilar argument applies to mechanistic explanations. One event is caused by another, the other by a third, and so on. But if we ask for a cause of the whole, we are driven again to the creator, who must himself be uncaused. All causal explanations, therefore, must have an arbitrary beginning. That is why it is no defect in the theory of the atomists to have left the original movements of the atoms unaccounted for. It must not be supposed that their reasons for their theories were wholly empirical. The atomic theory was revived in modern times to explain the facts of chemistry, but these facts were not known to the Greeks. There was no very sharp distinction in ancient times between empirical observation and logical argument. Parmenides, it is true, treated observed facts with contempt, but Empedocles and Anaxagoras would combine much of their metaphysics with observations on water clocks and whirling buckets. Until the Sophists, no philosopher seems to have doubted that a complete metaphysic and cosmology could be established by a combination of much reasoning and some observation. By good luck, the atomists hit on a hypothesis for which, more than 2,000 years later, some evidence was found. But their belief in their day was nonetheless destitute of any solid foundation. Like the other philosophers of his time, Leucippus was concerned to find a way of reconciling the arguments of Parmenides with the obvious fact of motion and change. As Aristotle says, although these opinions, those of Parmenides, appear to follow logically in a dialectical discussion, yet to believe them seems next door to madness when one considers the facts. For indeed, no lunatic seems to be so far out of his senses as to suppose that fire and ice are one. It is only between what is right and what seems right from habit that some people are mad enough to see no difference. Leucippus, however, thought he had a theory which harmonized with sense perception and would not abolish either coming to be and passing away, or motion and the multiplicity of things. He made these concessions to the facts of perception. On the other hand, he conceded to the monists that there could be no motion without a void. The result is a theory which he states as follows. The void is a not-being, and no part of what is a not-being. For what is, in the strict sense of the term, is an absolute plenum. This plenum, however, is not one. On the contrary, it is a many, infinite in number and invisible owing to the minuteness of their bulk. The many move in the void, for there is a void, and by coming together they produce coming to be, while by separating they produce passing away. Moreover, they act and suffer action whenever they chance to be in contact, for they are not one, and they generate by being put together and becoming intertwined. From the genuinely one, on the other hand, there could never have come to be a multiplicity, nor from the genuinely many a one. That is impossible. It will be seen that there was one point on which everybody so far was agreed, namely, that there could be no motion in a plenum. In this, all alike were mistaken. There can be cyclic motion in a plenum, provided it has always existed. The idea was that a thing could only move into an empty place, and that in a plenum there are no empty places. It might be contended, perhaps validly, that motion could never begin in a plenum, but it cannot be validly maintained that it could not occur at all. To the Greeks, however, it seemed that one must either acquiesce in the unchanging world of Parmenides or admit the void. Now, the arguments of Parmenides against not being seemed logically irrefutable against the void, and they were reinforced by the discovery that where there seems to be nothing, there is air. This is an example of the confused mixture of logic and observation that was common. We may put the Parmenidean position in this way. You say there is the void, therefore the void is not nothing. Therefore, it is not the void. It cannot be said that the atomists answered this argument. They merely proclaimed that they proposed to ignore it, on the ground that motion is a fact of experience, and therefore there must be a void, however difficult it may be to conceive. Footnote. Bailey maintains, on the contrary, that Leucippus had an answer which was extremely subtle. It consisted essentially in admitting the existence of something, the void, which was not corporeal. Similarly, Burnett says, it is a curious fact that the atomists, who are commonly regarded as the great materialists of antiquity, were actually the first to say distinctly that a thing might be real without being a body. End of footnote. Let us consider the subsequent history of this problem. The first and most obvious way of avoiding the logical difficulty is to distinguish between matter and space. According to this view, space is not nothing, but is of the nature of a receptacle, which may or may not have any given part filled with matter. Aristotle says, Physics, 208b, the theory that the void exists involves the existence of place, for one would define void as place bereft of body. This view is set forth with the utmost explicitness by Newton, who asserts the existence of absolute space and accordingly distinguishes absolute from relative motion. In the Copernican controversy, both sides, however little they may have realized it, were committed to this view, since they thought there was a difference between saying the heavens revolve from east to west and saying the earth rotates from west to east. If all motion is relative, these two statements are merely different ways of saying the same thing, like John is the father of James and James is the son of John. But if all motion is relative, and space is not substantial, we are left with the Parmenidean arguments against the void on our hands. Descartes, whose arguments are of just the same sort as those of early Greek philosophers, said that extension is the essence of matter, and therefore there is matter everywhere. For him, extension is an adjective, not a substantive. Its substantive is matter, and without its substantive it cannot exist. Empty space to him is as absurd as happiness without a sentient being who is happy. Leibniz, on somewhat different grounds, also believed in the plenum, but he maintained that space is merely a system of relations. On this subject, there was a famous controversy between him and Newton, the latter represented by Clark. The controversy remained undecided until the time of Einstein, whose theory conclusively gave the victory to Leibniz. The modern physicist, while he still believes that matter is in some sense atomic, does not believe in empty space. Where there is not matter, there is still something, notably light waves. Matter no longer has the lofty status that it acquired in philosophy through the arguments of Parmenides. It is not unchanging substance, but merely a way of grouping events. Some events belong to groups that can be regarded as material things, others, such as light waves, do not. It is the events that are the stuff of the world, and each of them is of brief duration. In this respect, modern physics is on the side of Heraclitus, as against Parmenides. But it was on the side of Parmenides until Einstein and quantum theory. As regards space, the modern view is that it is neither a substance, as Newton maintained, and as Leucippus and Democritus ought to have said, nor an adjective of extended bodies, as Descartes thought, but a system of relations, as Leibniz held. It is not by any means clear whether this view is compatible with the existence of the void. Perhaps, as a matter of abstract logic, it can be reconciled with the void. We might say that between any two things there is a certain greater or smaller distance, and that distance does not imply the existence of intermediate things. Such a point of view, however, would be impossible to utilize in modern physics. Since Einstein, distance is between events, not between things, and involves time as well as space. It is essentially a causal conception, and in modern physics, there is no action at a distance. All this, however, is based upon empirical rather than logical grounds. Moreover, the modern view cannot be stated except in terms of differential equations, and would therefore be unintelligible to the philosophers of antiquity. It would seem, accordingly, that the logical development of the views of the atomists is the Newtonian theory of absolute space, which meets the difficulty of attributing reality to not being. To this theory, there are no logical objections. The chief objection is that absolute space is absolutely unknowable, and cannot therefore be a necessary hypothesis in an empirical science. The more practical objection is that physics can get on without it. But the world of the atomists remains logically possible and is more akin to the actual world than is the world of any other of the ancient philosophers. Democritus worked out his theories in considerable detail, and some of the working out is interesting. Each atom, he said, was impenetrable and indivisible because it contained no void. When you use a knife to cut an apple, the knife has to find empty places where it can penetrate. If the apple contained no void, it would be infinitely hard and therefore physically indivisible. Each atom is internally unchanging and, in fact, a Parmenidean one. The only things that atoms do are to move and hit each other, and sometimes to combine when they happen to have shapes that are capable of interlocking. They are of all sorts of shapes. Fire is composed of small spherical atoms, and so is the soul. Atoms, by collision, produce vortices, which generate bodies and ultimately worlds. There are many worlds, some growing, some decaying. Some may have no sun or moon, some several. Every world has a beginning and an end. A world may be destroyed by collision with a larger world. This cosmology may be summarized in Shelley's words. Worlds on worlds are rolling ever from creation to decay, like the bubbles on a river, sparkling, bursting, borne away. Life developed out of the primeval slime. There is some fire everywhere in a living body, but most in the brain or in the breast. On this, authorities differ. Thought is a kind of motion and is thus able to cause motion elsewhere. Perception and thought are physical processes. Perception is of two sorts, one of the senses, one of the understanding. Perceptions of the latter sort depend only on the things perceived, while those of the former sort depend also on our senses and are therefore apt to be deceptive. Like Locke, Democritus held that such qualities as warmth, taste, and colour are not really in the object, but are due to our sense organs, while such qualities as weight, density, and hardness are really in the object. Democritus was a thoroughgoing materialist. For him, as we have seen, the soul was composed of atoms, and thought was a physical process. There was no purpose in the universe. There were only atoms governed by mechanical laws. He disbelieved in popular religion, and he argued against the nous of Anaxagoras. In ethics, he considered cheerfulness the goal of life, and regarded moderation and culture as the best means to it. He disliked everything violent and passionate. He disapproved of sex because he said it involved the overwhelming of consciousness by pleasure. He valued friendship, but thought ill of women, and did not desire children because their education interferes with philosophy. In all this, he was very like Jeremy Bentham. He was equally so in his love of what the Greeks called democracy. Footnote: poverty in a democracy is as much to be preferred to what is called prosperity under despots as freedom is to slavery, he says. End of footnote. Democritus, such at least is my opinion, is the last of the Greek philosophers to be free from a certain fault which vitiated all later ancient and medieval thought. All the philosophers we have been considering so far were engaged in a disinterested effort to understand the world. They thought it easier to understand than it is, but without this optimism they would not have had the courage to make a beginning. Their attitude, in the main, was genuinely scientific, wherever it did not merely embody the prejudices of their age. But it was not only scientific. It was imaginative and vigorous and filled with the delight of adventure. They were interested in everything, meteors and eclipses, fishes and whirlwinds, religion and morality. With a penetrating intellect, they combined the zest of children. From this point onwards, there are first certain seeds of decay, in spite of previously unmatched achievement, and then a gradual decadence. What is amiss, even in the best philosophy after Democritus, is an undue emphasis on man as compared with the universe. First comes skepticism, with the sophists, leading to a study of how we know rather than to the attempt to acquire fresh knowledge. Then comes, with Socrates, the emphasis on ethics. With Plato, the rejection of the world of sense in favor of the self-created world of pure thought. With Aristotle, the belief in purpose as the fundamental concept in science. In spite of the genius of Plato and Aristotle, their thought has vices which proved infinitely harmful. After their time, there was a decay of vigor and a gradual recrudescence of popular superstition. A partially new outlook arose as a result of the victory of Catholic orthodoxy. But it was not until the Renaissance that philosophy regained the vigor and independence that characterized the predecessors of Socrates. Chapter 10. Protagoras. The great pre-Socratic systems that we have been considering were confronted in the latter half of the 5th century by a skeptical movement in which the most important figure was Protagoras, chief of the Sophists. The word sophist had originally no bad connotation. It meant, as nearly as may be, what we mean by professor. A sophist was a man who made his living by teaching young men certain things that it was thought would be useful to them in practical life. As there was no public provision for such education, the sophists taught only those who had private means, or whose parents had. This tended to give them a certain class bias, which was increased by the political circumstances of the time. In Athens and many other cities, democracy was politically triumphant, but nothing had been done to diminish the wealth of those who belonged to the old aristocratic families. It was, in the main, the rich who embodied what appears to us as Hellenic culture. They had education and leisure. Travel had taken the edge off their traditional prejudices, and the time that they spent in discussion sharpened their wits. What was called democracy did not touch the institution of slavery, which enabled the rich to enjoy their wealth without oppressing free citizens. In many cities, however, and especially in Athens, the poorer citizens had towards the rich a double hostility, that of envy and that of traditionalism. The rich were supposed, often with justice, to be impious and immoral. They were subverting ancient beliefs and probably trying to destroy democracy. It thus happened that political democracy was associated with cultural conservatism, while those who were cultural innovators tended to be political reactionaries. Somewhat the same situation exists in modern America, where Tammany, as a mainly Catholic organization, is engaged in defending traditional theological and ethical dogmas against the assaults of Enlightenment. But the Enlightened are politically weaker in America than they were in Athens because they have failed to make common cause with the plutocracy. There is, however, one important and highly intellectual class which is concerned with the defense of the plutocracy, namely the class of corporation lawyers. In some respects, their functions are similar to those that were performed in Athens by the sophists. Athenian democracy, though it had the grave limitation of not including slaves or women, was in some respects more democratic than any modern system. Judges and most executive officers were chosen by lot and served for short periods. They were thus average citizens, like our jurymen, with the prejudices and lack of professionalism characteristic of average citizens. In general, there were a large number of judges to hear each case. The plaintiff and defendant, or prosecutor and accused, appeared in person, not through professional lawyers. Naturally, success or failure depended largely on oratorical skill in appealing to popular prejudices. Although a man had to deliver his own speech, he could hire an expert to write the speech for him, or, as many preferred, he could pay for instruction in the arts required for success in the law courts. These arts the sophists were supposed to teach. The age of Pericles is analogous in Athenian history to the Victorian age in the history of England. Athens was rich and powerful, not much troubled by wars, and possessed of a democratic constitution administered by aristocrats. As we have seen in connection with Anaxagoras, a democratic opposition to Pericles gradually gathered strength and attacked his friends one by one. The Peloponnesian War broke out in 431 BC. Footnote. It ended in 404 BC with the complete overthrow of Athens. End of footnote. Athens, in common with many other places, was ravaged by the plague. The population, which had been about 230,000, was greatly reduced, and never rose again to its former level. Berry, History of Greece, Chapter 1, page 444. Pericles himself, in 430 BC, was deposed from the office of general and fined for misappropriation of public money by a court composed of 1,501 judges. His two sons died of the plague, and he himself died in the following year, 429. Phidias and Anaxagoras were condemned. Aspasia was prosecuted for impiety and for keeping a disorderly house, but acquitted. In such a community, it was natural that men who were likely to incur the hostility of democratic politicians should wish to acquire forensic skill. For Athens, though much addicted to persecution, was in one respect less illiberal than modern America, since those accused of impiety and corrupting the young were allowed to plead in their own defense. This explains the popularity of the sophists with one class and their unpopularity with another. But in their own minds, they served more impersonal purposes,